Counsel, good morning to you. This is the case of In Re Estate of Lakin. We will begin by having members of the court introduce themselves. Justices Miller, Lerman, and Papik are recused. I am Mike Havikin. I am the Chief Justice and by order of seniority of service on the court. The other members of the court will introduce themselves.
My name is William Castle. Good morning.
Morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
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 I am Jeff Funk. Good morning.
Morning.
And I'm John Friedenberg.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good.
Very good, counsel. And I'll sort of take the role of everyone here. Mr. Lutz Prefert, are you with us today?
Yes, Your Honor.
And good morning to you. Mr. Hotz, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. Mr. Bausch, are you with us?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. And Ms. Trent Villam, are you with us?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Did I miss any counsel? No. I understand, Appellees, you're dividing your time three ways. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you are each taking approximately 3+ minutes, and you are going to have to govern that yourselves because our timer can't break that up. You understand that?
I understand that.
Very good. Do any counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
There you are.
Questions.
Very good. Mr. Lutz Prefert, you may proceed. Good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honors, may it please the court, Zachary Lutz Prefert on behalf of the Charles E. Lakin Foundation. I'd like to reserve 90 seconds for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case effectively is secrecy compounded upon secrecy compounded upon secrecy. And it all starts when Charles E. Lakin executes a secret promissory note in favor of Mr. Thomas Pribble. That promissory note was to become due upon the earlier of two events, Mr. Pribble's attaining age 60 or Mr. Lakin's death. According to Mr. Pribble, that note was secretly orally modified shortly before he turned 60, changing the due date to strictly being Mr. Lakin's death.
Nonetheless, Was Mr. Lakin able to secretly enter into this agreement during his lifetime, or were there any questions about his competency or undue influence or anything of that nature?
There are no questions regarding competency or undue influence, Your Honor. We don't believe that the note itself could be orally modified at that point in time from a public policy matter as well as from a statute of frauds aspect. Now, after Mr. Lakin died, Mr. Pribble, along with William Kilzer, became co-personal representatives of Mr. Lakin's estate, as well as co-trustees of his trust. In becoming co-personal representatives, both signed a pleading with the court, which alleged that they were not creditors of the estate. Nonetheless, the note was still there. Either this was a judicial admission that there was no debt outstanding, or another attempt at secrecy by Mr. Pribble, again trying to hide the fact that this debt existed. Now, effectively, Your Honors, the question before you is this. Was there a debt which could be paid? And it's uncontested that Mr. Lakin's trust allowed for payment of debts of Mr. Lakin. However, those had to have been valid debts of Mr. Lakin. Black's Law Dictionary defines a debt as a liability on a claim. To the extent that there is no liability on a claim, there was no debt. And to the extent that there was no debt, there was nothing that the trust could pay. Ultimately, there is no debt in this case that could be paid, and for a number of reasons. First, the Nebraska statute of limitations had run. Rejecting the notion that the agreement could be orally modified, the statute of limitations began to run when Mr. Pribble turned 60 in 2007. By 2012, that had run in its entirety. This was a demand note, which means that...
Does that assume that it's a promissory note and not a deferred compensation agreement?
No, Your Honor, either way, it was still a written document. If it's a promissory note, it's subject to the 5-year written statute of limitations. And if it's a deferred compensation agreement, it still would be an agreement subject to a 5-year statute of limitations. Now,
When would that a five-year statute of limitations run on a deferred compensation agreement?
The overwhelming majority of the note would have run in 2012. It creates a little bit of a unique situation.
If it's a promissory note, then a demand becomes an important date. If it's not a promissory note, it's deferred compensation. Does that affect the statute of limitations argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because ultimately the statute of limitations still would have started when he was entitled to start receiving payments under it, which, regardless of deferred compensation or promissory note, is 2007. Now, because the five-year statute of limitations would have run by 2012, in 2016, when Mr. Pribble actually received payment from Mr. Lakin's trust, clearly there was no debt to be paid. Additionally, there's the issue of the Nebraska Probate Code's claims bar statute. And again, regardless of promissory note or deferred compensation agreement, this sets a clear statutory period. And regardless of modification of the note, there's still a statutory claims bar period enforced here. Now, there's two periods that are relevant. If the note was not modified, it's a 60-day claim period. 60 days from the date of publication, a claim had to be filed. And if no claim was filed, it became barred by the statute of limitations. If the modification occurred,
opposing counsel seems to argue that this was not paid by the estate, so the estate proceedings are irrelevant, and this claims barred statute has no effect. So why is that not correct?
The claims bar statute is still absolutely relevant because the promissory note says it's to be paid by Charles's estate. While it's not contested that the trust has the ability to pay valid debts, the claims bar statute operates to make the promissory note an invalid debt if claims are not filed within the prescribed statutory time periods. Regardless of which statutory time period is looked at, and regardless of the other facts, no later than July of 2016, the claim was barred. And if the claim is barred, there can be no liability for the probate or the trust estate to pay. So even though the payment didn't come from the probate estate, you still have to look to the probate estate's laws because it was a debt of Charles individually, not a debt of his trust. It's important to note that in the promissory note, the trust does not appear anywhere. It doesn't appear as a signatory. It doesn't appear as a contemplated payor. The contemplated payor is strictly the Lakin estate. As a result, even though the trust had authority to pay, a statutory bar occurred. Additionally, the Nebraska Trust Code itself contemplates the fact that a statutory bar is in place because it requires for proceedings to be initiated against a trust, a claim to have been filed with the estate. Over and over again, the two issues end up interwoven with one another. They can't be separated. Ultimately, those three issues together, the fact that the trust proceedings weren't followed, the fact that the statute of limitations are running, the fact that the probate code's claims bar deadlines were not followed, all act to bar any liability upon the trust. As I said at the beginning, if there's no liability on a claim, there can be no debt. If there's no debt, then the trust had no authority to pay it. And if the trust paid a debt, which there was no liability for, it's improper. It should be refunded, and it constitutes a breach of fiduciary duties by Mr. Pribble and by Mr. Kilzer. On that issue of the breach of fiduciary duties, there's effectively this as the standard in place. Neither Mr. Kilzer nor Mr. Pribble could place themselves ahead of either the estate nor the trust, and neither of them could seek to harm the trust or the probate estate. Acknowledging the fact that the trust is the one that paid, the majority of the faults, the majority of these breaches are going to occur upon the trust. Mr. Pribble made a very active breach of trust. He failed to disallow a claim. He sought a claim benefiting only himself when otherwise no debt would be owed. He enriched himself to the tune of nearly $7 million and conversely harmed the trust and directly harmed the Lakin Foundation to the tune of nearly $7 million. On the other side of that, Your Honors, is Mr. Kilzer's actions. Mr. Kilzer's actions are that he failed to speak up against Mr. Lakin. Under either the probate or the trust code, neither Mr. Kilzer nor Mr. Pribble could act without the other one's consent. Mr. Kilzer went along every step of the way with Mr. Pribble's actions. Mr. Kilzer didn't object when Mr. Pribble paid himself. Mr. Kilzer didn't suggest the fact that they might need to seek a special representative or a special administrator. Mr. Kilzer didn't stand up. Mr. Pribble had a very active breach of his fiduciary duties. Mr. Kilzer's breach of fiduciary duties are strictly the fact that he sat by silently and did nothing. The compounding of those effects, plus the fact that we've already seen the debt was paid, establishes a clear error on behalf of the district court or the county court below. The county court found that there was no issues with the payments being made. The county court found that there were no issues with the
Lutz Preford, excuse me for interrupting. Is there a way that you think that Mr. Pribble could have done this correctly?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Mr. Pribble could have filed a claim as he's statutorily required to do. Mr. Pribble could have asked to the court to appoint a special representative and a special administrator in the trust and estate respectively, and he could have then proceeded with the claims while a special administrator and special representative resolved them from the trust standpoint. Then there's no conflict of interest. Mr. Pribble is fully welcome to seek his payment if he validly believes it's there, and conversely, the trust and its beneficiaries are not harmed. And with that, Your Honors, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel, hold on, I'm sorry. Counsel, before you do that, I do have a question about the issue of jurisdiction and whether this was a final appealable order issued by the county court. It doesn't seem that the court dealt with all of the issues set forth in your initial petition for suspension, removal of the trustee, things of that nature. Is this a final appealable order that we have jurisdiction to consider?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it is. While the issue of specific removal may not have directly been addressed, the fact that the court found that there was no breach of fiduciary duties, that the payments were not proper, effectively the court resolved it and made it impossible for the Lakin Foundation to prevail on the issue of removal. It did resolve specifically of all the other issues, including the matter of payment.
So the court implicitly denied your application?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Hotz, good morning to you. You may proceed.
Uh-oh.
I think
you're muted, Mr. Hotz.
You need to unmute yourself.
I'm sorry. May it please the court, my name is Edward Hotz. I represent Thomas Pribble and William Kilzer in their representative capacities. There is about 186 pages of briefing, either in support or in opposition to a 15-page order from the County Court of Douglas County, which is, we believe, well-reasoned, covers all the issues, and correctly resolved the issues before it. Now, with regard to a couple of issues, the County Court found that the note or deferred compensation agreement was, in fact, a deferred compensation agreement, and I think that was we believe that was a finding of fact, and to which the standard of review is that if it's clearly erroneous, it can be reversed. If not, it needs to be affirmed. With regard to the modification of the note that the counsel for the appellant was talking about at length, that modification was in favor of the foundation. It reduced the interest rate after 2007 from 12% to 6%. So I don't quite understand what the complaint is, because it was in favor of the foundation. Now the foundation is complaining about this. They're simply stating that Mr. Kilzer and Mr. Pribble breached their fiduciary duties because they didn't mark the checkbox on the application for informal probate. They didn't make a claim against the estate. They didn't examine the statute of limitations. With regard to that, the court's determination that it was a deferred compensation agreement, that deferred compensation continued to accrue annually on the anniversary of Mr. Pribble's employment with Mr. Lakin until his death in 2016. There is no question. I'll make a note here that the appellant does not make any comment about the intention of Charles Lakin. There's no dispute that Charles Lakin came up with the idea of this deferred compensation arrangement. He made it with Mr. Pribble as a long-term loyal employee after 12 years of employment. He wanted it to be secret by its terms because he didn't want his son, who ultimately was fired and disinherited, he didn't want his son to know how much money Mr. Pribble was making, either on a current or deferred basis. It was a collaborative effort to draft this agreement, and it was unquestionably signed by Mr. Lakin. And the terms of the note make clear that what Mr. Lakin's intent was. He was concerned, I'm talking about the secrecy provision of the note or the agreement, he was concerned for family reasons that it be remain confidential. So,
but obviously it couldn't remain confidential after he died.
No, that's correct. But remember, this agreement began in 1984 and went to 2016. And it did not, it was confidential between Pribble and Lakin up to.
Why would you file a document that said you were not a creditor of the estate?
Well, I think Mr. Pribble's explanation for that was that he considered those to be wages, an obligation of Mr. Lakin's ongoing business. And I think we need to call this what it is. This is an action by the terminated disinherited son to deprive Mr. Pribble of earned and vested deferred compensation that earned up to the time of Mr. Lakin's death. With that, I'm going to ask that, unless there are any questions, I'm going to stop arguing and let Mr. Bausch and Ms. Trent-Villem argue.
Ms. Trent-Villem, good morning to you. And you need to unmute.
I believe, Your Honor, I'm going to go first, if that's okay with the court. This is Trent Bausch.
That is fine, Mr. Bausch. I'm sorry. Good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Trent Bausch with Klein Williams, Wright, Johnson, and Oldfather, and I represent Tom Pribble in his individual capacity. These consolidated appeals were decided below as two separate matters, the estate case and the trust case. The county court correctly determined in both cases that Pribble and Kilzer did not breach their fiduciary duties in paying Pribble's deferred compensation. The standard of review applicable to consideration of the co-personal representatives administration of the estate demands that appellant establish that the county court's findings regarding Pribble and Kilzer's conduct were not supported by the evidence and were arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable. Appellant simply cannot meet that standard. First, this is a consolidated appeal of dueling motions for summary judgment. As such, the factual record before the court is not the source of any assignment of error. Second, because the payment under the compensation agreement at the core of the foundation's claim was made by the co-trustees of the trust, the probate code arguments simply do not apply to this case. And third, even if the probate court applied, which it does not, the county court's decision is consistent with Lakin's express intent and with the undisputed evidence. As this court reiterated last month, the cardinal rule in matters such as this is intent. I did not hear that word in Mr. Lutz Prefert's argument. Appellant's briefing doesn't mention Charles Lakin's intent, not even once, because Lakin made his intent crystal clear in the compensation agreement, his will, and his trust. Thus, the county court properly determined that no issues of material fact exist and correctly found that Pribble and Kilzer did not breach their fiduciary duties to the estate by paying pursuant to the compensation agreement or in any way delaying the administration of the estate with respect to the court's de novo review in the trust case. The undisputed evidence demonstrates that the county court's decision was correct. Appellant, yes, sir.
If this was decided on summary judgment, it isn't our standard of review de novo to determine whether or not there was a material dispute of fact.
Your Honor, there is no there is no appeal of the motion for summary judgment in that respect. Essentially, it's de novo based on the way that it's been pled and the assignments that were made. I would suggest to you it's errors on the record for the trust, for the estate case, and de novo of the trust case. I think that if you find that there was some sort of material issue of fact, I don't think that would be supported even in the pleadings of the parties or this appeal. I understand and agree that the standard of review certainly does indicate that, but in this particular case, due to the assignments of error, it's either de novo for the trust case or errors on the record for the estate case, we believe. Again, as I was saying regarding the undisputed evidence demonstrating that the county court's decision was correct in the trust case, appellant did not and cannot dispute that Lakin intended to provide deferred compensation to Pribble over 40 years while Pribble took a $5 million company and turned it into a $170 million company with Mr. Lakin. They cannot They cannot dispute that Lakin and Pribble amended the compensation agreement in 2000 so that Pribble would not make demand. That Pribble and Kilzer continued operating Lakin Enterprises following Lakin's death and had the authority to do so. That Pribble and Kilzer paid wages and other expenses of Lakin Enterprises. That Pribble and Kilzer were granted broad authority and discretion under the trust documents. That Pribble and Kilzer retained and relied on attorneys and accountants in calculating and paying Pribble's wages under the compensation agreement, and that Kilzer had nothing to personally gain from paying Pribble's wages. The county court correctly found that Pribble and Kilzer did not breach their fiduciary duties to the trust by processing and dispersing funds from the trust, which was Lakin's intent to pay Pribble pursuant to the compensation agreement, or by in any way delaying the administration of the trust. In conclusion, the county court did not commit any error, and Mr. Pribble respectfully requests that this court affirm the county court's decision. Absent questions from the court, I yield the remainder of appellee's time to Ms. Kathy Trent Villam.
Ms. Trent Villam, good morning to you. And you need to unmute.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Kathy Trent Villam, and I represent William Kilzer in his individual capacity. Mr. Kilzer did nothing wrong by fulfilling his grandfather's wishes, and the foundation's appeal fails because the foundation is asking the wrong questions. For the foundation to succeed, it needed to prove that Mr. Kilzer acted grossly negligent or engaged in willful misconduct when he approved the payment of the note from the trust. And the foundation could not and did not meet its burden of proof. The undisputed facts are that when Mr. Kilzer agreed, wearing his hat as co-trustee, to have the note paid from the trust funds, that he did so based on a note that instructed him to pay Mr. Pribble, based on a will that instructed that Mr. Lakin's debts be paid, based on a trust agreement that authorized the trustees to pay the grantor's debts. After months of conferring with legal counsel, who never suggested that there were any enforceability issues with the note or that there were any kind of procedural or claims bars, and using an amount that was calculated by Mr. Lakin's own accountant. Now, whether Mr. Kilzer was wrong in his interpretation of the agreements, whether he was wrong in his understanding and application of Nebraska law is beside the point. The question is, was he grossly negligent or did he engage in willful misconduct when he approved the notes? And under the facts, which the foundation concedes in its reply brief, Mr. Kilzer was not grossly negligent, let alone engaging in willful misconduct. This, of course, assumes that the court reaches the merits of the issue in the trust case, and that raises the jurisdictional question of whether a notice of appeal filed on behalf of an incorrectly identified party complies with the statutory requirements under 30-1601 and 25-1912. The notice of appeal in this case specifically identified the Charles E. Lakin Revocable Trust as the party intending to prosecute the appeal, and is signed by the Charles E. Lakin Revocable Trust, but it's signed by an attorney who did not represent and did not have the authority to act on behalf of the trust. There's no question that it was an inadvertent scrivener's error, but this court has found in previous situations that failure to strictly comply with the jurisdictional requirements results in a lack of appellate jurisdiction, and because this notice of appeal in the trust matter did not comply, there is no appellate jurisdiction for the issues in the trust case. I see that I'm out of time, so unless there are any questions, we'd ask that you affirm the county court's order in all respects. Thank you.
Ms. Trent, if the notice of appeal had not recited any party's name at all, but had been signed by the lawyer that signed it, would that have been sufficient to vest jurisdiction?
If it did not identify any party whatsoever, but was signed by the attorney for the foundation?
Yes.
Under 25-1912, it would need to be signed by the attorney or the appellant. And so specifically under that situation, Your Honor, I think it probably would, because in theory it was being signed by the appellant.
So here we have it signed by someone that would have been sufficient, but for, in your argument, the misstated identity of the party. Is that accurate?
Yes. And there's no doubt, Your Honor, that it is a technical argument and an inadvertent and good faith mistake. That, however, does not resolve and doesn't remedy the defect that appears on the face of the notice.
Thank you.
Counsel, I have a kind of an odd question. I understand using summary judgment in a will contest case before the district court, that these were proceedings before the county court. Help me understand how the use of summary judgment under our current statutory authorization of that proceeding was appropriate here.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, the summary judgment statutes are general statutes, and I don't think that there needed to be a specific trial on the merits in terms of calling live witnesses, because there really are no factual disputes. Nobody disputes that Mr. Lakin signed the agreement, that he had capacity, that he wasn't acting under undue influence. Nobody's disputing how the note was paid, the circumstances that led the note to be paid. So in this particular case, summary judgment seemed like a proper and easy means to get the issue in front of the court so that the court could decide the issue on the merits in light of the fact that there were no factual disputes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? 24 seconds, Mr. Lutz Prefert.
Thank you, Your Honors. Ultimately, in this case, what type of the document is, whether it's a promissory note or a deferred compensation, is irrelevant. Whether an amendment occurred is irrelevant. At the end of the day, Mr. Pribble failed to follow Nebraska law. He failed to make a timely claim upon the promissory note, and as a result, he is barred from recovery of it. And his payment of himself was grossly negligent. And Mr. Kilzer's not standing up and stopping the payment was grossly negligent. And for those reasons, this court should reverse and remand with appropriate instructions to the county court.
Mr. Lutz-Prefert, do you agree with opposing counsel that there are no material disputes of fact in this record?
Your Honor, I think the only disputed fact ultimately would be the issue of whether a secret oral amendment actually occurred. And because of the fact that there were two parties to the agreement and one of them is dead, it's impossible to actually create a disputed fact in that regard. The facts are clear. An improper payment occurred and it was outside of any statutory time. That is very clear and undisputed.
So with respect to the oral modification, was any evidence offered to suggest or imply, or from which a finder of fact could infer, that there had not been such an oral modification?
No, Your Honor, it would be impossible to do so, which is why the oral modification should not be permitted.
All right, so you're not disputing that summary judgment is the appropriate way of getting this in front of us?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you very much. And you are now excused. We greatly appreciate your participating by WebEx. And that concludes arguments for the day. So the court, too, is adjourned.